Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Hey, good Thursday to you. Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. We do appreciate you making the time to check in with us, listening on the radio or maybe online at myfaithradio.com, wherever you are. If you're in the Twin Cities area, maybe checking us out on our FM translator, just up and running at 90.7 FM. So check that out. Let us know. Love to connect with you on that and find out how it's coming in at your house or car. Ted Ross at the controls. Ted, looking forward to this hour. Our guest we've had on like half a dozen times or so, and I always enjoy the conversations because Drew knows his stuff.
Mm-hmm. Talking film today.
Yeah.
Academy Awards coming up a week from Sunday, if you care about that.
Well, we'll find out. You know, in fact, Drew Trotter, who is a theologian, he's executive director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers, and he's had a number of years as a film and popular culture critic, and has written a great deal about those issues, and also as a theologian, and has written some books helping us study God's Word more. In fact, does a seminar on how to watch a movie responsibly. In fact, is on his way tonight to give a annual lecture about the Academy Awards. Hmm. And so, Drew, welcome back to Connecting Faith First.
Thank you, Neil. It's good to be here.
You actually are giving a presentation, right? This is something you do every year about the Oscars, right?
Yes, that's right. Every year. It's called The Movies in America, What the Academy Award Nominees for Best Picture Tell Us About Ourselves. So it's kind of a look at the current state of the film industry and what nominees they made for Best Picture this year and how those match up with American society. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, since most of us probably aren't going to be going to Chattanooga to hear your lecture, can you give us a little preview about what do this year's crop tell us about ourselves? And we'll break it down more detail too, but maybe just some overview highlights.
Well, it's very interesting. I almost took the tact of looking at these pictures in light of what they have to say about family and marital relations, but I decided not to go quite that route, although Boyhood, of course, is very much oriented that way. But a major theme of Birdman is his relationship with his daughter and with his ex-wife. So there are a lot of things like that. But then I really think that running through almost each of these films, not every one by any means, but again, two in particular, and then others in a little less kind of importance, is a theme that made me think back to my college days of the philosophy of existentialism, that we simply live in the moment, that all we have is the moment, and so we might as well embrace it, because though it's absurd, because there is no God and there is no grounding in reality that's ultimate in significance, nevertheless, we have the moment, so let's live in it. And you see this quite clearly, I think, in Boyhood and even more clearly in Birdman. So it's fun to think about it that way. Some of the other films, of course, don't go in that direction at all, but I was surprised to see that popping up.
Mm. I guess, as Ted and I were just saying right at the beginning, do the Oscars really matter? I mean, does, the celebration coming up, and it's always kind of interesting to watch, but, I mean, does it make a difference to Hollywood? And if so, maybe in what way?
Well, it's funny you should say it that way, because even though it is a very, very popular program worldwide, it's lost in the ratings for years. And did a little better last year because Ellen DeGeneres is a funny person and more people had seen more of the films. Yeah, I think it does. And here's why. This Academy is made up of 4,000 or so of the finest practitioners alive in Hollywood today. And they vote for what they feel represents them the best. They're telling, in other words, they're telling America, this is what you should watch. This is what you should care about. These are the movies that matter. And even if it doesn't help much at the box office, there's often a little boost to a movie that wasn't seen very much. If it wins some major award, it comes back out and they see it. What happens in the long term is that people watch these movies. And so I mentioned this lecture. I give it, obviously, at this time of year, a number of times in a row. But I often give it in the fall. And interestingly, by that time, a lot of people have already have watched the movies on DVD or streaming them or whatever because of the extra emphasis that it gets from this very powerful industry. So I think they do matter.
Well, you know, we talked in the past that, you know, sometimes the movies don't have a lot of, you know, popular appeal. They're, you know, more
right.
artistic. But in the case of, you know, one of them that we'll maybe just jump in and talk about that is the war movie American Sniper. I mean, that's generated huge box office numbers, but also some criticism, you know, from some camps saying, well, this is glorifying modern day evil. Be interested in your perspective. I mean, what's making this a success?
Yeah, that is a fascinating question that everybody wishes they knew the answer to. It is, by the way, just to refer back to the previous conversation, it is the only serious box office draw at all of the eight pictures. In fact, only two others are even listed in the top 50 of this year in the box office revenues. So nobody is going to the other seven. But boy, American Sniper has broken several records. It is a phenomenon nobody even expected because Clint Eastwood usually draws fairly well, but not in the hundreds of millions. It's probably going to end up third on the list for films that came out in 2014. Well, there's several ideas about why. One is it's a war picture that really glorifies the American serviceman. And everybody you talk to, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, whoever they are, they really care about our men who go and get in harm's way on our behalf. Even if they don't like the war they're fighting in, generally, in terms of the political decision to go into it, everybody supports our servicemen and women. And so this one really presents a serviceman who is a true hero. This guy is amazing. He is the greatest sharpshooter in American history. He loves his wife. He loves his kids. This doesn't come out in the movie, but his philosophy of life was God, family, country, in that order, you know, kind of thing. So he really is a true American hero and presented very positively. The movie is very fast-paced. It goes right along. It follows him through four terms in Iraq, in the war. And some people have said, well, it's doing well because it's the first Iraq war movie that is positive and that is uplifting. There have been some good Iraq war movies. The Hurt Locker is probably the best-known one. But American Sniper has a much more positive view of America and of an American serviceman than even that movie did. So it deals with post-traumatic stress syndrome, but not really in quite in a despondent way or a despairing way. And it's a tragic story. He loved his wife very much and loved his family very much. But oddly enough, he goes through four tours of duty in Iraq and then happens to be murdered by a former veteran that he takes out to the firing range to try to help him and to try to help him work through his difficulties. And the trial of that guy is going on right now, so that's part of the controversy. Sure. A lot of people say it glorifies war. It glorifies snipers. Michael Moore made some ridiculous statements, as is his wont, because he had an uncle who was killed by a sniper in World War II, I think it was, or the Korean War. And so he was all mad that it glorified snipers who, he says, cheat. Well, okay, if you want to say espionage is wrong, if you want to say we shouldn't use everything that we possibly can to, win a war, then you might say that. But I think it's ridiculous. The other guys, the guys that he's killing have guns in their hands, know they're going into sniper-infested territory. It's always been a part of war, ever since the long rifle has been a part of war. And I think the controversy is really a tempest in a teacup in that regard.
Sure. Yeah, I was just curious. Does Clint Eastwood get support for his movies because of maybe his reputation? I mean, obviously, somebody has to finance all these things. I guess because I wanted to go back, say, as you talked about the beginning, these are films that Hollywood wants to say represents them. So is there really an interest in sort of positive and uplifting war stories or about war heroes?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Who knows why the Academy actually votes? I mean, again, 7 out of 8 times they voted for box office downers, and most of the movies are fairly downer in their perspective. The people in them have hard things that happen to them and don't necessarily have a great deal of hope. Now, that's not entirely true, but to some degree, that's true. Who knows why the Academy is voting? But yeah, they always respect their own, whether they're Republican or Democrat. Eastwood's kind of a strange figure politically because he appeared at the 2012 Republican convention in the famous interview with an empty chair, you know, and that sort of thing. But he wasn't a Republican all his life. He's been a Democrat at earlier times in his life, as Ronald Reagan was, in fact. So it's kind of interesting. His movies are always crisply done. They are always good movies, generally speaking, anyway. And, of course, he's won the Academy several times. So I think of Eastwood almost like Meryl Streep. Whatever they do, Hollywood is going to very strongly look at as a potential nominee for their for Best Picture or Best Actress or whatever. And he's won a couple of times. So there's no surprise, really, that American Sniper got nominated.
Mentioned Meryl Streep here. We'll, a little bit later in the show, we'll maybe talk about that. She comes up as a supporting role actress, and wondering, you know, what the challenge is for, you know, talented actors and actresses to play in a supporting role. Get some perspective on that. Also talk more about some of those other movies up for Academy Awards. The Oscars coming up in a couple of weeks, and we're doing a little preview today. And talk about, you know, what this says about us and maybe our faith. Get some good insight, as we always do, from Drew Trotter, Executive Director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers. He's a film and culture critic and a theologian, and a good friend of Faith Radio, and we're glad to have him on with us today. You may have a question or a comment. Maybe you've seen some of the nominees or just like to ask questions about the world of film and Hollywood. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. Or more with Drew Trotter coming up in a moment. Talking a little bit about Hollywood and some of the movies that they are voting on as the best of the best, the Oscars, the Academy Awards. It comes up February 22, and around this time, the last several years, we've connected with Drew Trotter, who serves his real job, his day job, as Executive Director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers, which is the wonderful group of thinking folks that are having a significant impact on university and college campuses around the country. Using modern culture and ways to connect faith to life. Drew has been writing and critiquing film and pop culture for a number of years, writes in Books and Culture and Christianity Today and other magazines. He's also a theologian and giving a lecture tonight, actually, on the Oscars and kind of the movies that were nominated, what they mean and say about us. And so we're getting some perspective of that. Talk a little bit about American Sniper and Clint Eastwood. It's another a war movie set in World War II, this time getting some attention, The Imitation Game. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that. And, of course, we know that, you know, part of the story has the lead character as a homosexual. So I'm just wondering, is it a war story or is it something else?
Well, it's one of several biopics that have been really, really important this year. This was a true story. Alan Turing, who helped break the code for the Nazi machine that they sent all their messages out on. And so the Allies, because of Turing's work, probably for a year before the war's ending knew exactly what the Germans were going to do and sculpted their whole strategy based on what Turing and his group had been able to accomplish by breaking this code that was so incredible, called the Enigma Code. But Turing, after that, was a Cambridge professor and had continued to go back to teaching and all that, but became a was a homosexual, and he was arrested for that and imprisoned for it in the 1950s. And so this is a topic of conversation now because, of course, it's no longer illegal in this country anyway to practice homosexuality, and at least I think in most states, and if not in all states, and the states where it is, I'm sure it's ignored completely now. So you have that controversy and that question that continues to make an impact on American society, and his treatment was harsh. And in fact, he chose to undergo therapy rather than go to prison that involved shock therapy and actually damaged him physically for the rest of his life. So it's not a pretty story, but the vast majority of it has to do with the real drama that was there in the breaking of this code and how they were able to figure out how to do it. And the way they did it was to build a machine that was the superior of the Enigma machine. And that machine was really the precursor for the modern day computer. And so Alan Turing is really a very, very well respected historical figure in computer science.
You know, it's based on a real story. It reminds me, too, I guess maybe we can talk about, real stories. Selma up for nomination, and some have argued that's not accurate. Should we expect historical accuracy in movies about real life events?
That's a great question and a very difficult one, because on the one hand, you're trying to balance the fact that a person is putting forth a movie clearly as a fictional account. You make selections in the thousands and thousands in every film that have to do with taking one particular slant over another, including camera angles and choices of scenes and choices of dialogue, et cetera, et cetera. Because of somebody else having the rights, Steven Spielberg, in fact, they could not even use Martin Luther King's exact words in the movie. So when you see David Oyelowo, a difficult name to pronounce, doing a great speech of Martin Luther King's, it's a rewritten speech. It captures the spirit very, very well. It's an extremely good performance, an extremely well-written screenplay, and great direction as well. But those are not exactly Martin Luther King's. It's a big controversy, of course. It shows the other side of the coin, and that is, if you're going to depict historical events, you ought to try as much as possible, it seems to me, to be fair to all the characters involved. And from what I know of it, even though the director and writer just strongly opposed this opinion, I don't think they were fair to Lyndon Johnson's role in the whole decisions that led up to making the decision to march on Selma. And I think most people probably believe that. They argue that they were, but they really don't have much of a leg to stand on, because it's quite clear from some of Johnson's speeches and things that he had written and memos and such that he had more of a favorable hand towards Martin Luther King doing what he did than the movie depicts. And, what can you say? They're trying to, in 2 hours, really show how important a role King had. And one way you do that is lessen the role of others. So, it's not a biopic about Lyndon Johnson. He's a character actor in this movie. And so you could argue that it's fair enough to use him however you want to. But it's not quite accurate. And the similar thing occurred in the Lincoln movie that Spielberg did that was phenomenally just a great movie. But some of the things are a little pushed in one direction or the other, and I think that's the case here.
Otherwise, what were your thoughts? I mean, a well done movie?
Oh, I think Selma's a very well done movie. I thought it lionized him too much. It's hagiographic almost. I mean, there's one brief scene of King discussing his infidelities with Coretta King, his wife, and that was clearly a part of his life and a strong part of it. And so they sort of briefly pay lip service to that aspect of King, but they don't really say much. At the same time, this is not about King and his whole life. It's about the events surrounding Selma. So, you know, again, how much do you press this? How fair is that? But the performance was great. The direction was great. And there's a lot of controversy about why they didn't get nominated. And my answer to that is, okay, who are you going to kick out? They had some very good movies this year with very good directors and very good actors. And I'm not sure that any one of them stands above the other in any kind of strong way enough to say, well, the racists in Hollywood just felt like they had had enough of African-American people. And so they didn't nominate this African-American woman for director, and they didn't nominate the African-American man for performance. Well, you'd have a hard time proving that because of the competition. It's very, very good this year.
And in terms of, yeah, those that are in leading actors and all those, it's well-known names and strong in their performances. You mentioned one thing, we got a couple of minutes before the break, just even about how, you know, camera angle can make a difference. So maybe just say a word about that. You know, when we go to a movie, I mean, it does affect maybe how we view it or how we see it or the outcome.
Oh, it's tremendous. It's tremendously important, the tricks that are used. I mean, camera angle can make a big difference. Boyhood begins with what's called a bird's eye view camera angle, where the camera is placed directly above the subject, that in a way to emphasize the sort of abstractness of the shot. And it's of this little boy who is the central character in this 2 hour and 45 minute long movie named Mason, who is just staring up into space. And a major theme of the whole movie will be this kid's sort of rootless wandering way through his life as he matures from the age of 6 to the age of 18. And it's a fascinating way in which they show you that right from the start, abstractly, him just sort of looking up, looking at the clouds, you know, and the end of the movie. He's essentially doing the same thing, though not quite in the same way. He's much more mature, much more grounded by that time. But he's still sort of at the beginning of his life as the movie looks at it. And it's a fascinating way in which, and that happens throughout all the movies, every movie you watch. The movie Birdman, which has the interesting subtitle, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Well, let me jump in, Drew. Let's pick that up after the break. We got a break coming up, and We'll talk about The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. That's a topic we want to discuss more, and we'll do that with Drew Trotter, who's a film and culture critic. He's executive director of the Consortium for Christian Studies Centers, and our guest today as we talk Oscars, 877-93-FAITH. Talking films today of the Oscars coming up here on the 22nd, and we find out what the best pictures are, and, you know, maybe more importantly, does it matter? Does it make a difference to us? In fact, Drew Trotter, our guest today, has given a discussion, leading a conversation on that even tonight about, you know, what the Oscar-nominated movies are, what they tell us about us. And so we'll get more reflection on that from Drew, who serves as executive director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers. He was executive director of the Center for Christian Study in Charlottesville, Virginia, for a number of years. He's written on film and pop culture for over 30 years, and also as a theologian. and does a seminar called Show and Tell, How to View a Movie Responsibly. And we've talked to Drew a number of times, and we're hitting on some of those Oscar-nominated movies just for some good reflection. And we mentioned, we're talking a little bit about camera angle before the break, and you brought up that the movie with the subtitle, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. Let's pick it up from there, Drew.
Okay, Birdman The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, uses the technique of a single shot with a handheld camera following the actors for as long as 15 or 20 minutes to try to develop in the viewer a sense of the momentary nature of this whole movie, that it's just one long extended moment is what it feels like because of that technique. So they use techniques like that all the time. But Birdman is probably the most interesting film, probably the best film of this year. It's not a very happy film to watch. It takes place in the confines of a theater in New York City where a man is trying to produce, having written and directed and starring in his own production, a play that will show that he's a serious actor. He has been Birdman, a superhero, for three films and refused to do the fourth one because he was so tired of playing such a shallow character. And now he wants to create a character of real worth and substance. And that's a lot of the movie. And it's interesting because the second title, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, comes from the New York Times review. I'm going to do a big spoiler alert if anybody's going to see the movie. At the end, the New York Times reviewer entitles her review of the play, The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, after opening night, because what has happened is the Michael Keaton character, Regan Thompson, has so wanted to be authentic and in the moment and have an existentially authentic moment that instead of firing a blank gun at himself and committing suicide to make the play end, he fires a real gun at himself and either mistakenly misses and just blows his nose off, or intended to blow his nose off in the first place. But that is real authenticity. The Times article writer thought that he did this ignorantly. He thought that he didn't even know he had a loaded gun in his hand. But you know, as the viewer, that he does know this. It is a fascinating exploration of the angst that goes along with being famous for nothing, you know, being famous for not having done anything. And celebrity, which is a huge topic of interest in our culture anyway, because so many people out there, even people listening to this broadcast, Neil, follow the idea of celebrity far too much and want to be known and want to be significant, when really you can find your significance in Christ and, frankly, find ultimate significance in Christ alone. So it is a fascinating study of the ways in which we seek significance in the world today, as is, again, I think, Boyhood. The two that people are really thinking are the ones that are contending for Best Picture.
Which, as we alluded to earlier, said that there is a lot of this kind of live in the moment in some of these movies. Is this different maybe as a theme than it was, say, a decade or two ago? Or has this always been sort of maybe an underlying theme coming out of Hollywood?
Well, as with anything like this, it comes and it goes. I haven't seen a sort of existentialist movie like this in a while, maybe since American Beauty back in 1999, which was really focused that way, I thought. It is a philosophy in our culture that is very common. And the way it's shaped at the end of Boyhood is positively. Yes, you live in the moment, but you've got a lot to live for. And that's, I think, a less profound way of understanding what existentialism really means, because it ignores major events in your life like death, which ends your moments. And if you don't know what is happening to you at death, then I think you really do have a reason to be anxious and a reason to be to be worried. And I think the same thing comes through in Birdman. There is a scene after the closing of the play, of course, in which he's in the hospital and they read the review to him, and he's become famous now in a way that he wanted to be, and it doesn't actually exorcise all of the demons that he has. And I won't tell you any more about what happens then. But, I think it's a philosophy that's out there in a lot of people's lives. I think most people just live each moment not caring and not worrying about it. And I think that really gives you a lackluster life. It really means you're simply going to live for yourself in the moment and take everything as it comes to you and not expect to make any difference or to build anything of meaning and significance in the world, which I think living a life before God gives significance to the work that you do. It gives significance to every day that you wake up. It gives significance to every relationship that you have and the way in which you treat it. It goes way beyond you. That is, in fact, and I'll use a word that only Christians use very much anymore, eternal. So I preached to you, Neil.
It was good that we are. I'm waiting for Ted. I'm waiting for Ted to get the offering basket out, and we'll no. We're just talking with Drew Trotter today, talking about the Oscars, some of the nominated movies, and what it says a little bit about us, some of the insights and lessons. It did make me wonder, Drew. What is it? What makes an actor Oscar worthy? Is it that they seem believable, or do we see their flaws? I was thinking, just as you've described some of these, Birdman, for example. I mean, is it how they handle conflict? What is there a unique theme that goes through?
It's really interesting, Neil, that you should ask that in light of the earlier conversation, because in Birdman, for instance, because it's all about acting, it's about a play within the movie. There is a lot said about authenticity and truth, and there's the Edward Norton character in Birdman, who plays a seasoned veteran of the stage in New York, but who's really a little bit of a pompous, arrogant kind of guy, and has his own seeking after celebrity underlying his motives and stuff, you come to find out. He talks about finding the truth in the role, the truth in the character, and there's a lot of reality to that. I think the more authentically you can portray this character, the better a performance it is. And I think that's what the Academy members are looking for. And the way you know that is simply the reaction of the audience. Do you sit there and really believe that Michael Keaton is Regan Thompson, or that Edward Norton is Mike Shiner in that movie? And if they do that, then you've achieved it. It's just that in movies, it's even harder because it's the function of so many other people, editors, lighting people, cinematographers, directors, all of these people have something to do with what kind of performance comes out on screen. And you can ruin a great performance by editing it poorly. It's not quite that simple. But I think that is what happens with great performances. They really have so inhabited the role that you believe they are that person.
Well, as you said, you can ruin a great performance by poor editing. Glenn called in and left a message. He's a Vietnam vet, and he says, from a Christian perspective, American Sniper had way too much swearing and using God's name in vain, which kind of brings up a point. What we fill our minds and hearts with matters. So can you address discernment maybe in what movies Christians should expose themselves to or not? And we've talked about this as well, this sort of overuse of inappropriate language.
I think it's a great point. First, I would say sometimes we denigrate language, and we shouldn't. It makes a huge difference what words we use, because it's the fourth commandment. It is John 1, where Jesus is likened to the Word. It's so important what language we actually use and how carefully we craft the sentences that we use. I think it's extremely important. You get into the historical argument there. I can remember when Saving Private Ryan came out, there were a number of World War II vets who were still alive and went to see that and wept at the performances. But the one thing they said over and over again was that that movie used swear words and language a whole lot more often than, and foul language rather, a whole lot more often than was their experience in World War II. And this vet has got a good point. There are a lot of soldiers out there who don't swear like that. But we know that there are soldiers who do. And I don't know, to make a point, perhaps the movie people feel like they've got to do that. Or, frankly, I think this is more the case, coming from their own lifestyles and their own way of seeing things and doing things, they fill the language with that kind of language. But, you know, for every guy like that that you find who calls in listening to a Christian radio station, you could probably find 20 who are out there who listen to the rock stations in wherever, you know, they are, and would call in and say, you know, there wasn't enough language. So it's hard to say. I don't know. I'm not a vet myself, but I take that guy at his word that he knew what his experience was quite clearly. And I think there might be really truth to that.
Well, maybe just in terms of kind of the second half of his question, then, so how would you address maybe issues of discernment in terms of what Christians should expose themselves to or not?
Well, we have talked about this, I remember, before, because I use a favorite term of mine. I think we need to know our own spiritual flashpoints. And I don't believe all movies are for everybody. I think more people ought to be going to more movies than they do, because I think we need to be regularly culturally aware, even if it's not a happy experience. You can't walk out of Birdman and feel encouraged or enlightened or happy. But that's okay. There are a lot of people in this world who aren't happy, who buy into the philosophy that it promotes, and we need to be able to understand that philosophy and relate to it. And I think we should be going to movies for reasons other than just our pure entertainment, and to make ourselves feel happy, because they are such cultural barometers. They really do tell us what's going on in the world in a way that we as Christians need to have, especially as the world continues to be divided more and more strongly between people of faith and people who don't believe in anything and don't like people of faith. So I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. Again, your first responsibility is to the Lord, and you need to be walking the kind of walk that he wants you to do. But I also think that you can objectify the experience of film going in such a way that much of what is presented on screen doesn't have to affect you as much as it usually does. But people haven't. That's what that seminar you referred to that I do tries to do for people, is give them some of the tools to be able to do that. And that's an important skill I think we should all learn.
Drew Trotter does a seminar called Show and Tell, How to View a Movie Responsibly. He's been a film and culture critic and written about this for about three decades now in publications like Books and Culture and Christianity Today and Critique. He's also a theologian, and he serves as executive director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers. We're going to talk in just a moment a little bit about the theory of everything, and one of the issues that we've just touched on briefly before is about realistic portrayal of Christians in movies. We'll get to that and more, but Drew Trotter coming up in just a moment. The folks who've been nominated, I guess, as stars, the best pictures and the best performers and directors and all those things. Talking about the world of film and the Oscars today, getting Academy Award perspectives from Drew Trotter, who's a film critic and theologian and serves as executive director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers. And Drew, one of the pictures up for nomination, The Theory of Everything, and I know, as I think we talked last time a little bit about that, that there's a character in there that actually portrays somewhat reasonably what a Christian, right?
That's right. It's nominated for Best Picture and Best Actor and Best Actress. And true story of the probably the most famous physicist of the 20th century, and he's still alive, so into the 21st, Stephen Hawking of Cambridge University in England, who married a Christian, a woman named Olivia Wilde. And she, you know, who knows whether she should have married him or not? That's a whole other question. But she was very serious about her faith and was able to hold her own in this film the way it's portrayed, which admittedly is based on her memoir. But nevertheless, from what I know of those two people, she was able to hold her own in their life together with her faith. And this is made a major subject in the film, and it's treated very respectfully. In fact, it'd be interesting to poll people who watched it whether she turns out to be more believable or he does in this whole dimension, because at the end of the movie, and it deals with their relationship primarily, she has a brief dalliance with another man because she's just had to spend her whole life keeping up with Stephen Hawking, who has Lou Gehrig's disease. And so she has to take care of him all of her life. But she breaks that off in order to really be with him and recommits herself to him in a full and final way. But he, in the end, falls in love with a nurse of his and discards her for this nurse. And it's a tragic story in many ways. It ends with them both being friendly towards each other, and that whole ending could be questioned as to whether it's useful and valid or not. But your question is very interesting, Neil, because it's rare that Christians are presented in a positive light in the movies, and yet The Theory of Everything, I think, really does.
Do Christians actually in Hollywood and in film and TV, maybe, do they have to hide their faith, you think, or do they end up getting it maybe in roles that don't give them the opportunity to maybe best represent the faith?
Well, it's a difficult question to ask. You know, for instance, what a Christian movie would actually look like, I don't know. I mean, we know about Chariots of Fire, and we think Christian movie. But it really was about two runners and their competition. And there's as much of the other character who's Jewish and not even who's a secular Jew as there is about Eric Little in that movie. They're really co-stars, and the movie is about both of their lives, almost in contrast to one another. So I don't even know what a Christian movie would look like. I don't know what a Christian role would look like, because there clearly are people of evil in the world. Let's hypothesize that they did a biopic of Adolf Hitler. Should a Christian not play that role? I don't know why not. He's a real character, and the character has meaning and significance to speak of in the world, but to speak of in terms of evil. So it seems to me if a Christian plays a gangster or a criminal, he should play him as horribly and as nastily as possible. Now, sometimes movies extol criminals, so there you've got a whole other problem. This is a perspective on the world that is there. Should a Christian not appear in such a movie? I have a hard time saying that they shouldn't. At the same time, it would seem to me that Christians would want to do the most that they could to portray non-Christians in a particular, or portray evil people in a particular light, and to portray Christians in a particular light as much as they could. And it gets really tricky. There's a well-known film that we talked about last time, as I recall, that still does well on video and DVD, and when it's on it's on television, is watched on a regular basis, and that is The Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Shawshank has been studied in Sunday school classes. It's been talked about in sermons ad infinitum. There is a very strong, almost allegorical way that you can read that particular story as Christian, with Andy Dufresne being the Jesus who was imprisoned wrongfully, you know, who shows the way of redemption to Morgan Freeman, his friend Red in the prison, and who frees him in the end, having gone through a sort of death experience, but then been resurrected. And, you know, Christians love this stuff and love this movie, but not a single person associated with it was a Christian. And not a single person intended it to be read in a Christian way. So art is a very difficult thing. And we can't really say one way or the other exactly how Christians, I think, should perform in Hollywood.
Well, I know our time is gone here, and we could chat for hours, as we always love to do when we get together. And Drew, I want to just thank you for giving us some good fresh perspective and something to think about here as we head into Oscar time here in the next couple of weeks.
Well, I've enjoyed it, Neil, as always. Unfortunately, I do ramble on sometimes, so sorry if I took us over.
You know, it's either just Ted or I talking, or we have intelligent guests in conversation. So thanks for doing your part. And you picked up the show substantially just being here. Drew Trotter is executive director of the Consortium of Christian Studies Centers, a film and pop culture critic, and we're glad to have him on with us today. Safe travels, and hope your session goes well tonight.
Thank you.
All right. Yep. Drew Trotter, join us today on Connecting Faith. We've got a few minutes left before today's program is done. And Ted, just I don't know if you're going to look at movies any differently now after hearing from Drew.
I always appreciate his insight. You know, he brings that biblical perspective to it, and he doesn't have his head in the sand either. And I like what he said about being culturally aware and being able to have a dialogue with non-believers about, you know, what people are talking about, but also bringing our perspective as believers into that. That was good.
Because movies are influential, and they do really represent or even set a tone. And so we have an opportunity to use that as a bridge, maybe, to talk about, is there a, you know, is there a question that we can raise, a spiritual question? So good insights, I think.
One of my favorite classes in college was cinema arts, actually, it was called, and just talked about the art of movie making and, you know, the psychological impact that even a shot has. If it's a high angle shot, you know, that means the characters are in danger. If it's a low angle shot looking up at a character, that means they're in power, you know, and just the things that go into it that you don't think about. And the thing I'll never forget, my professor said, become shot conscious. So maybe that's a takeaway for us today. As you're watching movies, just think about, well, what kind of shot are they using? What are they trying to say to me here in this? Then you can control the film instead of letting it control you.
Drew's done that seminar called Show and Tell, How to View a Movie Responsibly. It would be probably helpful for all of us view them responsibly. Hey, before we run out of time, I want to mention a couple of things. We just launched the sign-up for Commit to Live Fit. I don't know if you've been a longtime Faith Radio listener, but you know Susie Larson's done this over the last couple of years, I think, and this year we're doing it, I think we did last year as well, but doing it during Lent, and so it launches officially next Wednesday, Ash Wednesday, and it's an opportunity for you to actually get physically fit, but there's a spiritual component too, so we can get spiritually fit as well, and I want to just encourage you to find out about that. You can go online and sign up today, myfaithradio.com. It's myfaithradio.com. We just had a staff meeting this morning just kind of reading some of the email invitations to others too. And one of them was they were sweating for the wedding. Had a little group that was gonna jump in and get going on that. So check that out. I mean that would be a great experience. You know, it's not simply just, you know, giving up coffee or sugar or, you know, social media, whatever it is, but it's actually what do we have room for now and pursuing faith in a deeper level.
Some really sweet invitations there, too, between husbands and wives. You'd think, how do you invite somebody to be part of a fitness challenge? Yeah. But some really genuinely heartfelt, hey, I love you, let's do this together, and reaching out in love. So
check it out. Commit to Live Fit. You can sign up today and maybe invite a friend or two or ten to get involved. myfaithradio.com. It'll help make these winter months go by a little better, perhaps. Tomorrow, we're going to get a little pre-Valentine's information from Joel Rathmanner and Dave and Claudia Arp.
So where being a cheap date is not a bad thing, because you need to save money as a couple.
I resemble that remark, and I'll be listening in. It's a $10 great date, so things you can do on the cheap. You don't have to spend a lot of money to invest some time with your spouse. So check that out tomorrow, Joel Rathmanner, on the Friday installment of Connecting Faith. And the next week, We're going to hear from Rob Morgan. He's joining us Monday. We're going to talk about some principles for living life before it's over. Some great biblical insights. Kirby Stahl and Paul Stein are coming back, and we're going to talk estate planning, some of those things next week as well. And then Susan Gregory will join us on Ash Wednesday to talk about the Daniel fast. So got a great lineup next week. Glad to have you listening every day to Connecting Faith here on Faith Radio. It's myfaithradio.com.